Hello, everyone, and welcome to Awakening the Impulse to Evolve. My name is Craig Hamilton. I'm the founder of Integral Enlightenment, the organization producing this event. And I just wanted to say a quick thank you to all of you for your enthusiastic and heartfelt responses to the talk I gave on collective awakening this Tuesday. It means a lot to me to know that so many of you resonate with that message, as it's one of the things I'm most passionate about. And interestingly, a passion I share with Tom, so it's convenient we're doing this one tonight. I'm delighted to have all of you with us for session 12 of our series featuring Tom Attlee. The way the event's going to work tonight is that Tom and I will dialogue for about an hour, and then Tom will spend half an hour taking your questions. And then after that, for those of you who are interested in jumping into the conversation, we'll have our virtual evolutionary cafe where you can join with others in small group conversations about the topic. And the way this works is that each week immediately following the teleseminar, you can dial in through a different number, enter a personal PIN code, and come together with a small group of fellow evolutionaries in a facilitated conference call that enables you to explore the topics we just discussed on this call. And the good news is Tom will be joining us tonight for the cafe, so we'll hopefully get a little input from him there as well. To participate in that, you do need to create a personal PIN code. You can find information about how to do that in the emails that we sent you earlier this week. Okay, well, I'm really delighted to be here with Tom Attlee this evening. For those of you who don't know Tom, he's an evolutionary activist who's written and spoken about politics, democracy, and cultural transformation for over 20 years. He's the founder of the nonprofit Co-Intelligence Institute, and his articles on social issues and collective intelligence have appeared in journals worldwide. Raised in a Quaker activist family, Tom has been exploring social issues and personal and social transformation since an early age. His participation in the nine-month cross-country Great Peace March of 1986 marked a watershed in his own life. He served on the boards of the Berkeley Ecology Center and the Center for Group Learning. He's the author with Rosa Zubizarreta of the widely acclaimed book, The Tao of Democracy, Using Co-Intelligence to Create a World That Works for All. And his latest book is Reflections on Evolutionary Activism, Essays, Poems, and Prayers from an Emerging Field of Sacred Social Change. And personally, one of the things I really love about Tom is his passionate commitment to evolving the collective dimension of what it means to be human. He's a truly collectively conscious person in many of the ways I spoke about on Tuesday night. Tom and I, in fact, first met when I was working on a feature article on collective intelligence for What is Enlightenment magazine, and I interviewed him for that, and we've had many rich dialogues since then. And Tom is always a delight to talk with, so I'm sure we're in for a fascinating, mind-opening evening. So, Tom, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Awakening the Impulse to Evolve.
Same goes for you too, Craig. You're always fun to talk to.
Oh, great. Thanks. All right. Well, just to get us going, you've been a passionate activist for many decades, yet a few years ago, I know you went through a major shift in your orientation to life and to activism that was rooted in an awakening to the evolutionary worldview that we've been exploring on this series. So I was hoping you might just share with us your evolutionary awakening, how it happened, what it was that you sort of awoke to, and how that's changed and evolved your own thinking about activism.
Well, it has to do with Connie Barlow and Michael Dowd. During the early 2000s, I was doing a lot of work on making our democracy wiser, and that was a major centerpiece of my book, The Tao of Democracy. And people weren't terribly responding to it. You know, people were interested, but it didn't seem to be taking off. And Michael called me. He's been on my mailing list and sort of a distant colleague for a while. And he called me in late 2004, saying that I should he wanted me to help him organize the first evolutionary salon. And this is going to be about three dozen evolutionary activists and sacred spiritual people and scientists together for a week about in the middle of nowhere down in Southern California, and he wanted some guidance on how to do this. So we worked on it, and, you know, it was amazing. It was an amazing event. It was a little bit of World Cafe, what's called World Cafe, and a lot of open space, which is totally self-organized. And it was a major life change all by itself. And it came up with a vision of a movement for the conscious evolution of increasingly conscious social systems, which was like a mouthful, but it was like very interesting description of, for me, of things I'd already been doing. And I felt like I was being swirled into Michael and Connie's world in a major way. And I, you know, it was about a month later, I decided, this was in May 2005, and about a month later, I decided I should find out a little more about these people that I was getting so involved with. And they have all these DVDs of their talks, and I pulled one out and stuck it in my computer while I was, you know, brushing my teeth at my desk one night. And Connie's there talking to a bunch of Waldorf school teachers about how to talk about this stuff with kids. And she has this glass of water, and she says, well, you know, the hydrogen in this water is almost as old as the universe. Like 300,000 years after the Big Bang, hydrogen showed up. You know, it's like the dew precipitating all over the universe. Here's this hydrogen. And it hasn't change, you know, whatever, there haven't been a lot of new hydrogen atoms made, and these, whatever hydrogen atoms there are that old, you know. And the oxygen was made in the bellies of red giant stars that lived and died before our sun was born. And that's what we're made of, you know, and that's sort of what this whole planet's made of. And I was just sort of getting into that and sort of going, whoa, that's an interesting idea. And my desk started to turn into this glittering sparkle, like looking at a city from a hill at night, you know, the way the lights kind of sparkle, or looking at phosphorescence in the water at night. And then my whole co-op house just was this sparkling thing, and my body was this sparkling thing, and the sense that it wasn't just sitting there, it was going somewhere. It was like a wave unfolding. It was, and we were on one piece of this gigantic universe-sized wave that was unfolding. This little corner of this wave was going, whoa, boy, I'm a wave. I'm a sparkling wave of stardust. Bang energy. What the fuck's going on? You know, it's like, it was very definitely sort of an epiphanous experience. It was like, I had vanished. There was just this unfolding wave moving, and then it sort of settled down. I was back at my desk and brushing my teeth and going, whoa, that was intense. And that the consciousness, I mean, it's like there's like individual consciousness and the sense of the cosmic consciousness. But there's earlier, and again, I guess it was later, I got this realization, I am awakening systems, you know, that systems can be awake. The fact is, our body-mind is a system that's awake. And there's ways in which, with, you know, the media make us, the media are awake. You know, it's like there's a, you know, the Twin Towers get knocked down, and this collective consciousness of that event emerges. And the web, sort of like you look at Amazon.com, you know, and it's been pointed out that there's no body who knows everything on Amazon.com. You know, people who bought this book also bought that book. It's like that data is continually being updated, you know, and it's like there is this body of stuff emerging. It's like the systems themselves are waking up in various ways. And I got that all of my work in co-intelligence, all my work to make a wise democracy, to make a democratic system that behaves with intelligence and wisdom coherently, and is not destroying, you know, the ground it takes on, that is possible, and that's in fact what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a global organism that has humanity and nature and technologies all woven into some larger, complex, conscious thing. You know, I don't know, entity, organism, what's the language for it? You know, that is capable of sustaining itself. And it's right in the track of the increasing complexity of entities. You know, and it's not just complex, like complicated. It's like complexity is differentiated, something that has a lot of differentiation in, like all the cells in our body, but hyper-connected. So that all those differentiated pieces are super well woven together so that the whole is a coherent thing. You can say, oh, that's Tom, that's Craig. You know, these are separate entities, but within them, you start to get closer and closer, and it's like, whoa, this is a whole civilization, ecosystem, whatever, densely, you know, lots of diversity and incredibly dense interactivity going on all the time, and that's what we're building at the collective level for the whole planet. And that this is, there's a funny way in which we aren't doing it. You know, we are it. There's no difference between us and it. You know, this is, you know, thou art that. You know, we are it. We are that thing that is evolving, not just us all by ourselves, separate from everything else. We are one aspect of this giant evolutionary process that's been going on for at least 13.7 billion years, and we are this piece of it that is doing the thing that we're doing. And the calling is for, I got to a place where it's not horrible that we could implode as a civilization. Some people say we couldn't go extinct. I think we probably could. We could make this planet, you know, so it was, you know, more like Mars than like this. Maybe we have a few bacteria left over, whatever. There's a variety of really horrible things we could do. And instead of going, oh, this is so horrible, it must be stopped, it's like, oh, this is such a waste. You know, right. The consciousness that we have, and the consciousness that we have, I was listening to your discussion of, you know, what is consciousness and did it exist prior to the universe and all that. I feel like we're stuffing things into the same box and calling them by one word, and that's half the problems that we have. There is a kind of consciousness that has choice as a, if not the major feature of it. All the knowledge that we have is there to support choice. And the cosmic consciousness is not all that concerned with choice, you know. That's not where it's at.
Right.
So the kind of consciousness that we're dealing with here in terms of the rapid evolution of ours has to do with our choice. And the leap that we're trying to make, the thing all the co-intelligence work is, all the sustainability work, all this stuff is trying to go, you know, we are now aware of what's happening to us. Other prior entities, you know, organisms, even people, societies, were not aware of what was happening to them as it happened to them. Now we have these collective ways of seeing what's happening to us. And we're discovering we can weave some of the spiritual ways and scientific ways together, et cetera, you know, all these sensors out in space watching what's going on and computer modeling of climate and whatever. It's like these are all a giant collective cognitive process that is telling us what's going on. But we as individuals and we as systems don't know how to respond to that. You know, the fact that more than 50% of the people in the United States don't believe the scientists about global warming,
right,
about global melting, is a sign that the system itself, the culture, the system, the technologies are not built to link up what's perceived with action. It's like you're standing in the train, you know, train's coming down the tracks, you're standing in the tracks, you're looking at it, and you're going, you know, that must be a balloon, you know, or something. It's like there's a disconnect between what's going on and the ability to respond. And a lot of my collective intelligence work and the evolutionary activism work is like how to shift the larger systems that we live in, which includes political systems, it includes economic systems, and it includes cultural stories, it includes technologies, it includes our consciousness, know, how do we shift all of these things in a coordinated way so that they add up to our insightful perception of where we are in the long-term picture, what's happening, what's happened in the past, what's happening in the future, what's happening now, and that we are implicitly involved. You know, the idea of being co-creative, like Barbara Marx Hubbard says, there isn't a creative, it's not creativity that's going on, it's co-creativity. There's virtually no creativity that can be isolated from everything else.
Mm-hmm.
We are embedded in this, whether we know it or not, whether we want to be or not, you know, we are co-creating what happens next. And to wake up to that and go, you know, I'm part of this vast co-creative enterprise. I am connected to the co-creative powers of the universe. How do we pull that to its next step? How do we pull a miracle like putting oxygen and hydrogen together and getting water? I mean, come on. You know, that's a miracle. And there's a comparable miracle to putting together, you know, China and the United States and black and white and liberal and conservative and whatever, you know. There's something else that happens when you put those together that isn't just, you know, a bottle of hydrogen and oxygen. You know, there's a shift. And learning how to do that with some level of sophistication, which there's amazing amounts of knowledge about that, all bit and piece so far. It hasn't been woven together, but it's coming together, you know, whether it'll be quote unquote in time and what that means, I don't know. But the I remember looking at the cells dividing when I was in biology class in high school, and they had these movies of the cells dividing, and there's sort of the cell is sitting there, and then suddenly stuff starts to happen. So it's like, it gets really busy inside that cell. There's stuff wildly moving around. And I feel like that's happening right now. The level of activity and things, synchronicities and, you know, sudden connections and the ability to create effects with minimal, you know, kinds of things. This 4 years Go campaign that is coming out, which I highly recommend everybody, you know, check that out. It's like 4 years, you know, what happens in the next 4 years will be critical to what life is like for the next 1,000 years. So wherever your passion is, whatever you're doing that could make a difference, upgrade it, you know. Put it into the bigger picture. Start connecting up with other people. We need to make a serious difference in 4 years, and we are embedded in this larger unfolding. And that, you know, the stitch in time saves nine, the butterfly effect. You know, we are in a time, this window. What's her name call it? The window of.
Who, Elizabeth Satori?
Transformational window, whatever. There's a window of chaos, you know. That there's a point where the systems that were so resistant, as an activist, you know, trying to change the systems, you know, it's like pounding your head against a brick wall. You know, they don't want to change. Their systems are built to not change. They're very resistant to change. That's how they stay coherent, you know. So you're there trying to change the military, trying to change the, you know, oppressive systems, you know, and they're resisting and resisting. And right now they're coming to pieces. You know, all over the place, systems are coming to pieces, and there is this space where we still have enough resources, and we have gigantically, vastly increasing knowledge of what to do and how to do it, and to, you know, put our shoulders to the wheel or whatever the right metaphor is now, and stop acting like there's business as usual is still what's going on, because it's, I keep using this metaphor, like people who have a leg cut off or an arm cut off, and they keep feeling like it's there.
Phantom limb pain.
Yeah,
right.
Limb phenomena.
Yeah.
We have a phantom business as usual. Business as usual looks like it's still going on, but it's not, and there's this gnawing feeling that something's wrong here, but what's wrong is the old way is coming apart. And that's when the butterfly effect makes a difference. You know, so having, for me, the evolutionary activism thing is inspired by the story, you know, and the fact that we are stardust and we are the evolutionary process. I mean, the inspiration of that is gigantic. awe. And then it's inspired, it's informed by evolutionary dynamics. You know, like Michael says, you know, there's evolution loves a crisis. You know,
business chance for big change.
Mm-hmm.
A chance for big change.
Yeah, it's like this is where the novelty comes from. This is where the next leap comes from. And the fact that it has a do-or-die quality, it's like a rite of passage. You know, the rite of passage isn't something light. It's something that has a test in it. It's something that you come up to the edge in, and then you make it, and you're different on the other side.
Well, let me ask you just, because, I mean, you just laid out a lot, and, you know, sharing your own story was also really inspiring. I felt myself on that wave with you, so... You know, it's all really great and incredibly articulate, laying out of a lot of the territory. And I want to get a sense for you. Do you feel that this evolutionary epiphany, as you call it, did it change the act? Did it change your relationship to activism itself? Did it change the things that you think need to happen and how to, and your sense of how to make them happen? Or did it just give you a larger context, a bigger way, you know, a larger picture within which to understand the activism that you're already doing? Or both?
All of the above and more. And there's a funny way in which that epiphany was like, you know, that day you're on the cushion and it all becomes clear when you really have a blowout experience. And then, you know, hey, you'd like to have it back, but it doesn't come back.
Sure.
And the harder you try, there's a sense in which it opened windows, you know, the doors of perception, open doors of perception. And I have been, since then, trying to discover what's that made of, what's going on there. I can still touch base with it, you know.
Yeah.
I don't have the same blowout quality, and I love turning people onto it. I have a vivid impression of telling this guy in a kitchen in this party once, you know, did you know the Big Bang never stopped? This is it. He's just like, oh, my God. Ah, he got it. Other people just stare at you blankly. They don't get it.
But that's when you have to pick up the glass of water and do the water thing.
There's a way in which that was, it's like a bonding experience. You know, the kids, the baby's born, and the mother has all this surge of hormones going through her, and the baby is just so beautiful, it doesn't matter what it looks like, you know. And you need to have that bonding experience for all the difficulties that are coming up when you're raising a kid, you know, species go on. There's a similar, when you have an epiphanous experience like that, it shifts your perspective in some profound way and gnaws at you. You know, I've got to figure out how this fits. I've got to tap into the message this was giving me. You know, something was being relayed here that is more important than just having the experience again. And that a large part of my book, probably at least half of the book on Reflections on Evolution and Activism, came from correspondence with Michael. You know, there's a very interesting dynamic tensions with between me and Michael, and tremendous admiration on both sides, and trying to fathom, because for me, I don't understand how you can have conscious evolution without evolutionary activism. I mean, to me, it's the alien concept. You know, you need to be engaged in transforming the social systems and cultures which will make that big global organism. that's the project on the table. You know? So for me, it's really obvious, and Michael and Connie focus primarily on the celebratory and the personal dimensions, you know, evolutionary psychology stuff, which is great. But I was just hungry for what's the activist dimension of this.
Mm.
And it was just driving me nuts because I have very strong activist roots, and I've had many watersheds. The Peace March was one, an experience where I was part of an intense dialogue between conservatives and liberals, which I realized that the whole concept of progressive and liberal was a barrier for me to make allies with people, you know, with conservative people who are just really remarkable people, and all sorts of things we found that we could connect up on. It was like, whoa, have I been in a box? You know, so I've had a number of, you know, major shifts in my perspective on what activism is all about. But it all is activism. I mean, for me, activism, this is from my being raised, it's like my life has something profound to do with what's going on out there. I am not just somebody going through the motions of being a person. You know, there's I'm implicated, and there's responsibilities, and there's opportunities, and it's like the bond between my life and what's going on out there is really solid, but that bond keeps changing. You know, what's the nature of it? What am I supposed to do with that? And so the evolutionary activism is like a whole different reflection. And here I can go, I am an evolutionary activist. I am an agent of conscious evolution. I am also evolution becoming conscious of itself. You know, that there you go further and further into loss of self-boundaries into this other perspective. I have a thing on my wall that I put some of into the book. That my life is a gift from the whole of life to the whole of life. And the emergent part of my life that I think of as me gets to evolve by practicing stewardship of my life on behalf of all life in the sacred great story of evolution. So that there's an interesting way. I was thinking I took a nap before coming on here, and it occurred to me that this is in like the Hindu tradition. It has all these different yogas, all these different paths. You know, and devotion and service and action are all yogas that you can do. This is in that world. This is not the meditation cushion is a piece of the picture that can help, but it's not the center. The center is service, is action, and in this case, evolution, conscious evolutionary participation in the big systemic cultural shift that is underway and is going in directions that are sustainable and directions that aren't sustainable. And we get, you know, it's so perfectly designed for us to learn what we need to do. You know, each crisis is like this. It's not just an opportunity. It's filled with information. And it's exactly the information that we need to embrace and, you know, find our right relationship with as guidance into what we're supposed to do next. And that exercise of doing that is a spiritual practice and is the practice of, you know, bringing to birth a new civilization that actually works. You know.
I'm feeling compelled, since you spoke so much about how you're really living into these questions, how it's not like you got the epiphany and then it downloaded itself in a series of insights that you've documented and packaged up, but that it's really a living inquiry for you. It makes me want to just spend some time unpacking, well, what are the insights from evolution that do change the way we think about activism, or enlarge the context for our activism, or even guide our sense of what kind of activism would make sense. I mean, one thing that struck me hearing you was just how, you know, there can be an experience for those who have been involved in a lot of social change work, and you gave voice to it, which is that man, it's really hard to get things to change. Systems don't want to change, and a lot of people end up feeling defeated after years of pushing hard, you know, putting all their passion and energy into something, and then it doesn't really end up happening like they had hoped, and you know, they just feel they're up against a system that can't change. And yet one of the insights from looking at evolution and seeing it is that everything's always changing, and if we look at our evolutionary past, we see that radical, profound changes have happened at key moments that you never could have imagined, you know, from prior to their occurring. And so there's something about, I think, embracing the evolutionary worldview that does, it's an empowering and a very life-positive kind of energy and awareness that one comes into where one is not going to let oneself be daunted, maybe in some of the same ways one might, by the seeming intractability of systems.
One of the things it does for me is it gets rid of optimism and pessimism.
That's interesting. Yeah, say more about that.
Optimism and pessimism are spectator sports. You know, either it's going to all come apart or it's going to all be great. And it's like, forget it. That's not what's going on. What's going on is we're all participants. How are we going to participate? You know, it's in the moment. How it ends up, we have no idea and we don't have control over. And it's a waste of time and energy and a disempowering and disconnecting, alienating thing to say, well, it's going to be horrible or it's going to be wonderful. It's all the forces of the universe are here working with us and everything's going to be cool. And it's like, forget it. We are all
right.
In this together,
mm.
For better and worse. And, I mean, there's so many.
What you're saying is it getting rid of any kind of simplistic us versus them thinking. Well, the big military industrial complex that we could never possibly change, right? It's
yeah.
Like, well, somebody's got to change it. If it's going to change, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and you can't change it by making it the other too thoroughly. One of the things I've been talking about for several years when the Bush administration, of course, I was just watching things coming apart in the Bush administration. I had my despairs, et cetera. And then I had this wild idea. I think it was really right after I got into the evolutionary stuff. It's like, we should have a massive demonstration in Washington, hundreds of thousands of people, in the media everywhere, and we are celebrating George Bush as the greatest transformational agent on the planet. Because under his tutelage, the whole game is coming apart. And that is such a gift. And now the ball's in our court. Are we ready to take it? We can't just do the blame game anymore. And it's a funny thing happening with Obama. All the progressives are going, oh, my gosh, Obama's not doing this, Obama's doing that. Well, hello. What does this tell us about the system we're living in? We don't get a leader who does it for us. We need to change the system. You can have people like Obama and people like Bush rising to the top, and you watch the same stuff going on. It's like time to move upstream a bit and go, why is this happening? for me, one of the biggest lessons, and this is something I've been exploring with Peggy Holman for, she was also part of that evolutionary salon work and facilitated the open space, is that dissonance, disturbance, used wisely, generates energies and insights and breakthroughs that we need. Our relationship to disturbance is possibly the most important thing we need to learn about and nurture, having a positive relationship to disturbance. Which is a sense in which some of the stuff that you were talking about in a community, the kind of spiritual communities you're talking about, that's a dimension of that work, is that you're using disturbance to learn and transform in.
Mm.
And our society is undergoing lots of disturbance. And Peggy just finished writing a book on emergence in social systems.
Mm.
And it's going to be out in the fall. And it's about all the dynamics of how to creatively use disturbance and not waste it, not just push against it. And for me, the understanding that new things emerge in evolution primarily through disturbance. And we need to do that consciously. When everything's going along pocket to pocket to pocket, you don't necessarily have to be particularly conscious of it. In using the choiceful definition of consciousness, because the automaticities are working. When the automaticities stop working, when you get a pain, when you're hungry, when, you're unemployed, when people are running airplanes into buildings, hello, there's disturbance. The message of disturbance is pay attention. learn what is trying to come through, and reorient yourself. Do the transformations that are necessary. So how to do that? We're still at Kitty Hawk learning how to do that, but there's lots of, we can get the, if you know what you're doing, you can get the plane down the beach. We don't have intercontinental traffic yet, you know, but to do it in a learningful way, to say we need to learn how to do this better, and we need to use the disturbances to help us learn how to do this better. That is evolution becoming conscious of itself. So for me, that's probably the most central one.
Can you give a practical example of one place in which you see that happening or have seen it happen within a social change context?
And Peggy's world is a great one because she's working with journalists. There's a project that she's been working on for about 8 years called Journalism That Matters. The field of journalism is visibly collapsing before our eyes. It's constantly being talked about. Newspapers are closing, the TV. The challenge from the web is wiping out journalism. And the whole concept of journalism as a profession that has standards, and these wild, woolly web people, bloggers and stuff, don't have these standards, and we need to preserve the, et cetera, et cetera. She's been doing open space conference, which she gets, professional journalists and editors and publishers and bloggers and media critics and, people who teach journalism. It's called getting the whole system in the room.
Yeah.
And then giving them a couple of days to create sessions for themselves. What do you want to talk about? So this is what she's been doing for 8 years. And it's been growing. It now has major journalism schools and journalism, foundations and stuff working with it, and people from the New York Times and Wall Street Journal showing up, And what she saw is about a year and a half ago, she was doing one of these Journalism That Matters conferences, and they say creating journalism as a conversation, not journalism as a lecture. So engaging people in much more creative ways. And what she saw was bloggers and unemployed journalists, professional journalists, getting together to create totally new forms of journalism that have never existed before.
Like what, for instance?
There's a lot of community-oriented journalism, and it's like you've heard of community-supported agriculture, where the community is saying we're gonna support these people in doing this thing and having investigative reporting. In the community itself, which is supported by the people of the community, and where you have the newsroom is in a cafe, anybody can come into the newsroom and feed in information and ideas, where things are being co-created on wikis, where journalists are, and this is on an edge, the journalism are still figuring out we know how to do this, the journalists are still figuring out. But the idea of having journalists convene conversations of people in the community and then report on those conversations to the community. So like the kind of powerful conversations we know where a community can bring together diverse players and come up with useful insights and, options and policies, whatever, for the community, which happens a lot. So, all over the country, there's hundreds of those things happening, every month in different forms, different places, but hardly anybody knows they even happen. So journalists being there to nurture these conversations and feed that new understanding and insight and possibility back into the larger community through their journalism, these are just some of the things that are brewing in that, which have a totally different feel to them than back in the New York Times.
Fascinating. Well,
and I have one or two other ones I'd really like to share.
Yeah, great.
The one that Michael pushes that I've adopted and I see more and more applications for it is aligning the self-interest of the parts to the well-being of the whole. An example of this, he talks a lot about, you got to have, various penalties and whatever, incentives to get people to do this. That's one of the ways you align people. But having, for example, what they call in green economic theory, internalizing the costs. So you can create
cotton shirts, for example, that use tremendous amounts of pesticides and destroy the soil. Those are two things cotton is really good at.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do it mass production and create really cheap cotton shirts. That's the way our, you know, and the toxins that are created by that, you know, go downstream. The company doesn't have to pay for it. And, you know, it's like future generations and, you know, taxpayers end up having to pay for that kind of stuff. And that's called externalizing the cost. It doesn't have to be in the price because the company's not having to pay anything on that.
Right.
So to internalize the cost means to say, figure out what the costs of that kind of thing are and put it into the price of the good. Suddenly it's more expensive to get a poison shirt than it is to get an organic cotton shirt, you know, or something made out of hemp, whatever. It's like to be able to have the economy as a whole, the free market is this powerful self-organizing system, but it's self-organizing itself over a cliff right now because you don't account for all the destruction it's doing.
Right.
Our gross domestic product, this thing we measure, our economic growth, how healthy is the economy? It was pointed out that the Exxon Valdez that crashed and put all this oil in the water was the most productive oil tanker voyage in history because
all the
money
they
had spent cleaning up, all the environmental groups that got money for, you know, claiming this, the money had to be paid. It's just money, 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 money. Cancer, great. You know, more cancer there is, the more GDP goes up. In the meantime, if you mow your own lawn or take care of your own kids, that's not measured at all. You know, it's like something is wrong with the way we measure what's worth doing and what's healthy. So making an economy that is, you know, at the corporate level, at the price level, at the level of our overall measurements that make it so that individuals pursuing their self-interest within that context benefit the whole instead of destroying the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's a design problem, you know. So
now you were bringing that up as an example of somewhere you're seeing some real headway? Or
well, there's tremendous research on this, and there's there are some companies who work on what's called the triple bottom line,
right?
Which is the, you know, the people, the, you know, the communities that they're impacting and their workplaces, the people, the environments, and the financial bottom line, all three of those. And there are a massively growing social responsible investment world.
Mm-hmm.
So there's things called stockholder activism, where the stockholders are organizing to, you know, shift the way companies are behaving. There's lots of stuff happening. It's nowhere near as big as the other stuff that's going on, you know. But it is growing rapidly, and from an evolutionary perspective, you go, we want to shift the DNA of the society, the things that society uses to reproduce itself. We want to shift that, you know. There are all sorts of suffering people. There's all sorts of destruction being happened. We are conditioned biologically to respond to that. But that's not what's that stuff is being caused by something else that we're not seeing. You know, so part of the evolutionary activism is getting aware of the invisibles, you know, that we aren't biologically made to see, but we have the culture and the science and the, you know, technologies that enable us to see them, to realize that is a new perceptive, it's a new way of being collectively conscious and collectively intelligent. We need to consciously rise into that, you know, and to deal with the causes, the invisible causes, and somehow loosen our attachment to saving the individuals, saving the forest, saving the, you know, the effort to deal with the crisis that's right in front of our nose, you know, that's one. It's like I have in my book as a chapter on does compassion itself need to evolve? Because compassion is largely grounded in our biological makeup, how we evolved to respond and care and all that. And
say more about that. So what would the evolution of compassion look like?
Yeah,
what direction?
the evolution, it's like expanded, you talk about the expansion of care. And the direction is towards seeing where caring action will actually transform the suffering in major ways.
So in other words, the Ken Wilber uses the term idiot compassion, which I'm not sure you'd go along with, but he's in a sense pointing out that our compassion, the effect of our compassion is only as good as the wisdom that's informing our sensibilities about what kind of care would actually make a difference.
Yes.
In some
way. And it's, and it's a, there's points where it's painful, where I don't, like in my own life, if you go to an edge, it's really hard for me, is in my partner Karen's cancer. And it was, she was going to be, it was way back in 2007, I was, I'd been dreaming of doing this conference on story, story field. We live inside this field of narrative that is very dysfunctional. And what is it like as activists to actually shift that narrative, to consciously address that narrative and do things to shift, like the feminists did. The feminists did profound shifting in the narrative of our culture. And to do that, you know, the sustainability, people are trying to do that, et cetera. But being conscious about it, because there's things to know about that. So I wanted, I have worked on creating this conference. I dreamed about it for 10 years, and Peggy and I organized it for a year. And right before the conference, Karen gets diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And it's like, do I go to this conference or not? You know? And it was a very, and, you know, Karen and I have a very mutually generous relationship, and she definitely wanted me to go, and she's getting a friend to come up and go to the chemo doctor with her or whatever. And I was really torn up about it. You know, it's like, and the sense that we, that as things come apart, people, more and more suffering is going to be generated by the systems as they come apart. And all the attention of people who are following their human responsiveness is going to help the me and mine, or the suffering person I see in the, you know, over the media, whatever. And hardly any is going to, where is that coming from?
Actually addressing the causes, the leverage points that would make a difference.
And my horrible vision is of it spinning, it's worse and worse. Because we're not handling the cause, there's more and more of the effects. And more resources are being poured into handling the effects until there's no more resources.
Mm-hmm.
And then it spins out, and that's the end game. You know, it's like, how, and so that's part of, and but at the same time, I can't say, well, Karen, you deal with your own cancer. I got work to do. You know, it's like, well, what do we do with that?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling that there are, if there was a movement around this kind of, it would be, this would be a collective concern, because everybody's got that. I have people I'm connected to here who are trying to organize the community from the city level or from the grassroots level to respond to, you know, peak oil and climate change. Gigantic challenges. And, hey, they got to keep their jobs. You know, it's like there's something about the way the system is built, and we have no time. You know, hello, we have no time. What's that about? You know, there's something about the way the system is built that makes it so it's really hard to change the system. So as an evolutionary activist, we go, we're here not to handle the effects. We're here to try collectively to support whatever's needed to shift the larger systems, cultures, beliefs, technologies that are causing this stuff.
Well, let me ask you about this.
Each other, because this is a source of disturbance, and every source of disturbance has important messages for us. So the fact that I am disturbed about this in my life is filled with information that in a larger community of activists would be being digested to figure out what is the transformation being called, we are being called to in this, and figuring out how to do that.
Well, yeah, and I'd like to push into that a little more with you, because and talk about what in one of the sort of we might call predicaments of evolutionaries, because, you know, I've I work with a lot of people who self-identify as evolutionaries in my own courses and clearly on this series and so many other contexts. And one thing I know many of us are feeling is this kind of, there's a kind of sense of overwhelm in the face of the need that we see in the world, that there's so many things that need to change, that need our attention. And many people, you know, some people have a cause that just compels them from within. They're passionate about it. They're giving everything to it, and it's clear. But many are unsure about, where do I give my time, energy, and money to have the greatest impact? And so I have kind of two questions for you that are interrelated. One is, well, what do you see, given that you're somebody who really is thinking about all this pretty much full time, whereas many don't have that, you know, opportunities, they're so embroiled in other concerns. What do you see as the most powerful leverage points for bringing about the kind of evolutionary change that is most needed, that would make a difference? And then the second question is, well, and how do you recommend evolutionaries go about sifting through? Because obviously, to some degree, that's a universal question. To some degree, it's a personal question for each person to find their own answer to. But even what process do you recommend people to undertake to try to find the place where they could make the most difference, the sweet spot for their contribution to, that would really matter? Because obviously, we can all find a thousand things to do with our time that would help on some level. But would they be evolutionary? Maybe not. So.
Well, all of it's evolutionary. You can't not do it. There's nothing you can do that isn't evolutionary, first of all. to me, the question is the level of consciousness. You know, that's, you know, to what extent are we conscious of it, and to what extent are we moving our individual and collective consciousness in ways that allow us to take in more and do more creative stuff with whatever we're taking in. And for me, I put gigantic hope in the development of conversational technologies. I will just give one, because examples tend to sit better than theoretical stuff. There's the most powerful conflict transformation process I know is called dynamic facilitation. And my favorite story from dynamic facilitation to illustrate its potency is when I was in a class, it was actually the same week that Seattle was blowing up around the WTO back in 1999. I was taking my first class in dynamic facilitation, and we had chosen the healthcare system as something that we would talk about as a very diverse group in the class and practice facilitating ourselves, looking for solutions to the healthcare crisis. And right at the beginning, this guy behind me says, well, first of all, we have to keep it out of the government's hand, because the government messes up everything it touches. And, of course, I was raised in a socialist family, and I turned around and said, you're full of it, you know. And this facilitator came right up to me, like was like 2 feet away from me, and said, give it to me, what's your concern? You know, and I turned around. As I was turning around, because I'm really conscious of these kinds of dynamics, I was watching what was happening, and it was like an Aikido move. I had something to offer. He had something to offer. I was making it unsafe for him to give his offering, and was creating this weird node of energy in the room, and the facilitator was translating all that into a concern, asking me what my concern was, and as I'm telling her, she's putting up, you know, writing this stuff up on these chart pads and saying, am I getting this right? Is this the way it is? Are you really blah, 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 blah? You know, so I'm feeling more and more heard what she's saying. You know, what I'm saying is actually being heard by somebody and registered in the collective group. And there's this loosening of energy in me and a sort of waiting to see what's next. You know, she gets to a point and says, so what? How would you handle that? You know, and I go, well, I don't know. Well, good, time to move on to somebody else. You know, it's like, and to think of that kind of capacity, that knowledge of translating something to concern, if you listen to somebody fully, most people have not been fully heard in their lifetime. You know, I have experienced a number of times of being fully heard, where I had no more I could think to say. And it's transformational. It shifts who you are. It's one of the most powerful ego transformational processes, you know, is to actually fully hear somebody. And to have that kind of transformational potential practiced in the larger world, have it institutionalized, you know, have it, and that's part of the, what my book, the Tao of Democracy is about taking the processes which when you, communication, you know, dialogue and deliberation, conversation, taking the processes for that, that have demonstrated that when people, diverse people, are involved in those processes, their manifested level of awareness goes up. They manifest a deeper connection to each other, a deeper connection to the larger issues and systems they're embedded in because of the nature of the processes. If everybody was the same, of course, it might not change anything, but they're different. And if they're not allowed to separate from each other, if they're called upon to really hear each other, they have no choice but to go deeper. You know, it's a very powerful dynamic. And to have more policy making and program making and whatever be in the hands of ad hoc groups like that who are pulled together on behalf of the community, on behalf of the country, whatever, to come up with something that we can do. And it is nothing like Congress. You know, it's nothing like a public hearing. It is something, it is a radically different form of engagement. And it is collectively intelligent and potentially collectively wise. And if we had more of that plugged into the government in various ways, that of course I can talk more about if anybody's interested, but there's like to actually give power to that capacity. These people leave these things and they go right back to being the way they were before. You know, they have hit, they have had an experience. So usually people are profoundly impacted, go, wow, I never knew it could be like that, whatever. But as a level of consciousness and engagement, once they're separated and back in their things, they go, like half the people who do meditation retreats, you know, go back and you do your thing. But we have taken people of ordinary levels of consciousness and awareness, we have pumped that up through these processes, and we have empowered that. While you're up there in that wise place, tell us what to do. And they come up with the things which then structure what's going on. And that is a way to bypass what to me is this impossible problem of getting everybody enlightened in time, you know. I was joking with a friend, you know, you don't have to be enlightened to not destroy the world.
Let's hope not.
there are ways to get wisdom injected into the system, to get ego moved off to the side of the system, so that in these little windows that you give power to, things can shift so that the structures change in ways like I was talking about, change the economy, you know, change the democracy, whatever. The structures change so that ordinary people with all their limitations start producing something that's viable instead of something that's massively collectively self-destructive. You know, and it's being aware of those differences. And the, my book tells whole piles of them and describes projects. There's probably about 100 different projects that are already going on, to say nothing of ones that are emerging, which for various reasons I give the logic of, according to evolutionary dynamics, would be more worth supporting than other things. The perspective of the evolutionary perspective, the more you understand about evolutionary dynamics, the more clarifying it gives about what we should be focusing on and how we should go about doing this stuff. And again, this is a gigantic topic, and I'm talking more about it.
We've had a moment to touch into it here, and obviously we're going to move into the question and answer section here in just a few minutes. But before we do, I'm just wondering if you'd like to tell us a little bit about what some of the practical things you're currently working on or any invitations you'd like to extend to the listeners. Obviously, there's your book, Reflections on Evolutionary Activism, which we can learn about at cointelligence.org. That's co-intelligence.org.
And evolutionaryactivism.com. That's the website, and it will tell you where, like I just set up a Facebook group for people who want to talk about this stuff. And I'm for people who are reading the book, I'm doing phone calls each month, which you can, you know, look at if people are actually reading the book, and we can talk about that. So there's a variety of activities. And this could create this, I don't know whether this conversation with you is going to create a shift, because since the book came out in December, there was a little flurry at the beginning, but I didn't have access to the audience that I originally wrote it for, which was largely Michael and Connie's world, that their you know, email list is dysfunctional, and I never got a chance to reach out to them. So I don't know. It felt like there's very little happening in that world. And I said, okay, well, the meme's out there, and I shift. There's all sorts of exciting stuff happening in the wise democracy world now, out in the world, demanding my attention. So I put most of my attention on that. And it depends on what kind of interest shows up from this, that there may be more. And the fact that I, just because we were going to have this conversation, I did some interesting thinking on ego and we go and evolutionary change and this as a this whole movement as a spiritual practice, which I it's suddenly very exciting, and people who are on this call might be interested in that approach more than the other ways that I've talked about it. But my own, the thing that I am currently most involved in are new possibilities and our ability to generate an authentic, inclusive, democratic voice of the whole. That's one of my deep dreams and motivations, is to, it's not something that dominates, but it's like there are ways for the diversity that we see now in battle to be in a cooperative enterprise that creates higher, more integral solutions. And we don't currently have structures in our political and governance process to tap into that capacity. But there are people who are now doing things that if those pieces, if like half dozen or a dozen pieces came together, we'd have the structure, the already in projects, we have structure for a radically new form of democracy, which is this one comes apart, which is obviously happening in front of our eyes. Watching healthcare debate, you know, you're going, there's something wrong with the way this machine works. You know? So having something that's in place, you know, operating at a low level but visible, that is obviously works much better than what we have, that is, there's tremendous energy out in the world right now that I am working with and making connections. So that's probably my biggest focus. And I love the evolutionary activism stuff. I think it's not going to be so much of a movement as a perspective, a way of looking at things that people carry into what they're already doing. But, hey, I don't know.
I think you should make it into a movement. I like it. Evolutionaryactivism.com. Evolutionary Activism, the new movement.
We need
the social change movement.
Organizers.
Yeah.
He's the real organizers. I'm not an organizer. I'm a visionary and a philosopher. So if there's real organizers that show up, I'm really happy to be thinking partners with them.
Well, the social change movement certainly needs an infusion of the kind of passion and context and everything you've been sharing tonight. So may it spread. We're going to go ahead and jump over to the question and answer section. We'll give it some people a chance to engage with you. If you have a question for Tom, simply send us your question via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer, or dial into the conference line number and press *2 to let us know that you have a question. That raises your hand on my computer interface and I can call on you. That's not the Maestro conference number, which is where we host the Evolutionary Cafe in about half an hour from now. That's a separate number, so just to keep it clear, it's all in the emails we sent you. All right, before we take your questions, just a few things to let you know about from our sponsors. First, I'd like to thank our partners at Gaia Community, an online sanctuary of nearly 300,000 seekers, artists, and visionaries committed to inspiring and empowering each other to live lives of purpose and authenticity. And also at Gaia Soulmates, their new fledgling dating site for singles seeking a partner who shares their values of spiritual awareness and personal inquiry. It's Gaia.com. That's GAIA.com. Also, wanted to tell you about the Integral Education and Sustainability Seminar coming up this summer. If you've ever wished you could dive deeper into the actual application of an integral perspective to education or ecology, there will be over 20 of today's top integral teachers there, including Diane Hamilton, Sean Esbjorn Hargens, Terry Patton, Claire Zammit, myself, Stefan Martineau, all coming together for the first time in a double stream seminar to explore the depth and breadth of awareness required to effect positive change in these times. That's going to be in Mount Madonna Center near the Bay Area of California, August 3rd through 8th. For more information, you can visit www.i-edu.org. That's i-edu.org. Or just go to nextstepintegral.org and find the link. Also, if you live near the San Francisco Bay Area, you're invited to participate in a unique experiment in integral and evolutionary spiritual community where we'll be digging into many of the kinds of dialogue processes that Tom spoke about and is interested in. From March through December of this year, it'll be hosted by Terry Patton, author of Integral Life Practice, and myself. We're going to guide a collective exploration of what it means to sustain an authentic evolutionary spiritual practice amidst the complexities and challenges of modern life. So join us as we explore how to create a culture together that helps us grow and evolve and contribute to the emergence of a humane and sustainable world. To learn about that, visit awakeningtogethercourse.com. That's awakeningtogethercourse.com. And for anybody not necessarily in the Bay Area but still interested in this work, I'd like to invite you to check out my 9-week Integral Enlightenment telecourse starting in April. You can learn more about this and other upcoming Integral Enlightenment course offerings at academyforevolutionaries.com. That's academyforevolutionaries.com. Okay, on to the questions. If you have one, simply send it to us via instant message in the teleseminar window or dial into the conference line number and press *2 to let us know. And let's see who we have on the line. Okay, I have a question from someone in Portland, Oregon. Hi there, you're on. Or at least somebody whose phone number is in Portland, Oregon. I don't have your name.
That may well be me. I raised my hand on the phone.
Okay, hi.
Hey, hi. I'm Holly Wells, and I've had a few kind of one-sided conversations with Tom. Love to watch it, you know, the development of his stuff. Tom, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what's happening in Oregon. I heard about third hand that there was some kind of legislation passed that there would be a citizens committee or shadow group or something. Do you know about that? And can you tell us a little bit about what's happening?
Yeah, this is an example of plugging in these kind of conversations into the system.
Right.
There's a ballot initiative process in Oregon and a couple of dozen other states where people can propose, you know, new laws. And what this is called Citizen Initiative Review, and it's based on citizen juries, which is not the legal juries. This is a system where you get a randomly selected group of a couple of dozen people from the community, in fact, cross-section of the community, which is sort of like a jury, and then you inform them about whatever the issue is they're supposed to be deliberating on, and then help them talk together about it and get the information they need, and they come up with some finding about it. That's a citizen jury. And so this model is being applied to between 1 and 3 ballot initiatives in Oregon this year, and this was legislation that was passed as a trial. They're not committing to it yet. But the people who are for and against the initiatives will speak to this randomly, you know, each initiative will have a separate citizen deliberative council, citizen initiative review, and the people who are for and against it will give their evidences and their arguments, and then these people will deliberate on it and come up with either a together statement or a statement like the Supreme Court does, and there's a majority and minority opinion, whatever. Whatever they come up with will be printed in the voter information along with all the partisan arguments. And people are going to see what happens when they do that.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks for your question. Okay. have a question from Emil in East Rochester, New York. Hi, you're on.
Hi, thanks. I'm so excited about your work, both Craig and Tom, but especially Tom talking about the evolutionary activism, and I love the comment that you made about, you know, it can't just be words. We have to be put into action that is service-oriented on behalf of the whole and not just the individual interests. I love that, and I do think it's state-of-the-art evolutionary consciousness, so I'm happy to be aboard with you. And I also love your idea about creating a new form of journalism. I come from three generations of journalists. My father's column was called Voice from the Grandstand. And I love the idea of being a voice of the evolutionary impulse. And I'm wondering, have you, I noted that you said you're not an organizer, you're more of a philosopher. I do have to say with the utmost loving kindness, shame on you, because the philosopher just begins and ends in words. So you're not really living up to your own philosophy. I challenge you to put this idea into action. I'd like to join with you in it to make it a reality, whether it's in cyberspace or however.
Well, one of my very provocative comments, of course.
I got to poke you in the ribs there, Tom.
That's fine. The disturbance is generative.
Thank you.
One of the, probably, evolution is not my bottom line, really. Wholeness is my bottom line.
Uh-huh.
Evolution is a dynamic of wholeness for me.
Uh-huh.
And one of the best lessons I ever got on wholeness was a guy named Charlie Johnson from Seattle, and he said that we should not decide whether someone or something is good or bad or right or wrong. Our job is to decide what are its gifts, what are its limitations, and where does it fit. And I realized that there's another one, too, which I got from Peggy, which is what is trying to emerge, what is possible now. You know, and if we are asking those questions all the time, and having that as our attitude. So I don't claim to walk my talk. The whole walking my talk thing, you should walk your talk, it's like there's ways in which that's really important and there's ways in which that's a distraction. It's not about me, you know. Mm-hmm. It's about this larger effort. So what are the gifts that I have to bring to the larger effort? You know, what are my natural things that I do really well and things which nobody else could do? And what are the limitations? And when I understand that, where is it that I fit? And what's missing to make a whole that's more functional? You know, the idea that we all have to be whole is to me a black hole, a very dangerous attitude. What's important is that we understand what our strengths and weaknesses are, and we understand we need other people, and we need to weave. That's the whole thing. It's weaving diversity. It's not everybody. It's like beads on a string. You know, if there's no holes in the string, no holes in the beads, you can't put the string on. You know, it's like our shortcomings are like the indents in a puzzle that somebody else can fit in. You know, you put the puzzle together with all the indents and the outdents and whatever. So it's, you know, I don't really feel provoked by your question. You know, I have gone over this over and over in my own life, and I've watched what happens when I try to do work that I'm not built to do and how it sucks my life energy and things do not get done. So I feel my job is to put out something that's inspirational in a broad enough way that the people who find it meaningful, if it's right, we'll self-organize into something, and I'm happy to be part of that self-organized action.
Well, that was brilliant, and it's important to know thyself. It's like the kidney knowing what its job is in relation to the lungs or the
right.
liver or the heart, and so I totally appreciate and love that, so thank you. for that clarity. For that clarity, yeah.
Let's not ask the kidney to breathe.
Too long. Right.
Thank you for your question. Appreciate it. Okay. Great. Okay. So anybody who has a question, press star 2. Who's dialed in by phone, press star 2, and we'll bring you on. I'm going to go over and check the online interface, see who sent in questions via instant message. Okay, Tom, here's a couple of questions from a mutual friend of ours. Christine Whitney Sanchez asks, hi, Tom, what's your belief / experience regarding the relationships between the evolution of individuals, groups, organizations, communities, societies, the relationship between the evolution of those different things? And she's going to ask one other one here, so I'll just throw them together. And what's the most potent evolutionary action we can collectively take? She's got two.
Oh, boy. Well, I don't know the answer to that question. I think probably it's to ask that question in forums where you can make progress with it is probably the most important. That's not as cop-out as it looks. In terms of the first question, it is real to me that all this is kind of fractal or feeds into each other. It's sort of like the structures, the stories we tell ourselves, the structures of society, et cetera, the culture we live in, shape our consciousness. And our consciousness shapes those things. So it's like it's a big circular pattern. There's a giant feedback loop. And there's a sense in which you could enter it anywhere and make a difference because it's all connected. The question that I bring out of that understanding is asking what change in consciousness will have the most profound effect on social systems, and what change in social systems will have the most profound desirable effect on consciousness. So it's in that inquiry that a lot of my work is, and I feel like, you know, people who are, I had a conversation with Rosa Zubizarreta about this, a woman who had helped me so much on the Dawa Democracy, and who's a leader in the dynamic facilitation world. The idea that people who are more enlightened about all this can be of tremendous service by convening and facilitating and hosting the kinds of conversations where less enlightened people manifest enlightened consciousness. You know, that's an act of evolutionary leadership to do that. You know, so becoming a dynamic facilitator, becoming an open space facilitator, becoming a future search facilitator, it's all these technologies that do this kind of thing, to become part of that where you're doing it as an evolutionary act, and you're not just going, what business is going to pay me next to do my next gig? But you're going, where can I bring this skill in a way, like an acupuncturist on the whole system, where can I bring this skill to free up the energy to move towards possibility, whatever. So that's an example of an individual who develops themselves in order to serve the whole. And at the same time, getting together in groups of support, you know, groups that have both challenge and support in them, you know, some variant of the sort of thing that that Craig was talking about on Tuesday, or the feminist groups, the fact that feminism was incredibly innovative. You know, the consciousness-raising groups, you had these women getting together to talk about their lives. These were not, let's study the literature of oppression. They got together to talk about their lives, and they found out that they're all experiencing the same stuff. And it's like, where does that come from? I thought it was about me, but it's not. In the language of the personal is the political, you know, the system is embedded in me. I am a manifestation of the system. You know, how do I wake up from the dysfunctional parts of that, and how do we together take action to change that? So those support groups, you know, are those support groups about the individuals? Are they about the group? Are they about the society? It's about all of them. You know, there's a way in which you can do these actions in a way that embrace all levels in some way. I guess that's the best answer I could give to her first question. And the second question is, like, there's an initiative called Transition Towns, which is specifically for for the challenge of the twin challenge of climate change and peak oil, you know, where larger systems that we depend on are going to start to fray and come apart, and we need to be more self-reliant wherever we are. And it's a brilliant model, and it has lots of open space and World Cafe in it. You know, it is not the ideal learning community, but it could be made even more powerful as a learning community, a global learning community of how do we do this well. That's an example of some very sophisticated system. Permaculture is another very sophisticated system. You can learn how to be part of that. As far as I'm concerned, the highest leverage is in the strategic use of powerful conversation. So becoming part of a learning community who deals with conversation and figuring out how to use that strategically, acupuncturally for social change. You know, the interaction of diverse entities is what evolution is all about. So consciously helping diverse entities interact in ways that create conscious evolution is, to me, the sine qua non. So, but I realize I'm biased in that way, and I don't know what the best way is, but that's a highly potent way.
Exciting. Well, thank you. That's great. I really appreciate that point because it is, you're uplifting. I would imagine many people who would ask that question that Christine asked about the most potent evolutionary action would not even have on their list what you just articulated. So I think it's great to, you know, invoke that in the activist context and really show why it would work. Okay, I'm going to take a question from Blake Anderson in Calgary. It says, you mentioned no longer holding the distinction between liberals, conservatives, progressives, etc. When we consider Ken Wilber's distinctions between modernist, postmodern, and integral values and the cultural clashes that occur because of them, how do we go about acting on evolutionary activism considering these distinctions?
Well, all models are, you know, all models are traps and some are useful. And to whenever we put things into boxes, you know, there's a little warning light that goes on for me. These are dimensions of our humanity, dimensions of our community. These are not boxes that people are in. The fact is, when you randomly select people who are across the boards in their political views, in their, you know, how you would evaluate them in terms of their, you know, levels of consciousness or maturity or whatever, and you put them in a really powerful process, they behave differently than you'd think if you were looking at them in their box. You know, just the fact that they weren't picked because they were liberal or conservative makes them behave. They were picked because they're citizens and they're caring about their country and they're supposed to do something about it or their community. The context you put people in has a profound impact on who they are. So I know Paul Ray once said, if you could demonstrate that, you know, his three categories of people, the traditionals, the moderns, and the cultural creatives, you know, they have such different values. How could they possibly work together? If you could demonstrate, it would totally transform the field of political science and sociology. I went, well, it's happening all the time, Paul. I don't know what to say. You know, we designed a whole protocol, which has never been done, but it's just like this is a reality, and these analytical tools that categorize people are useful up to a point, and at the point where they get in the way of people relating and doing co-creative work together, they cease to be valuable. You know, that's all I would say at this point. I think it's a gigantic subject to deal with.
Okay, great. I have a question from your neck of the woods and perhaps even from your own community there, from John Abbey. I don't know if he's living in your...
He's living in my house.
Your co-op house, okay. Well, he doesn't get enough of your ear over dinner, so he's asking this way. He says, evolutionary dynamics obviously changed a lot with the advent of living things, in particular with the ability of life to produce many copies of itself, which could then collaborate and compete. How do you see it changing again with the advent of human-level consciousness? What new abilities does consciousness allow for that you see contributing to next-level evolution?
Oh, boy. Thank you, John.
You can go punch him after the call.
Could you repeat that question?
Yeah, he said evolutionary dynamics obviously changed a lot with the advent of living things, and particularly with the ability of life to produce many copies of itself, which could then collaborate and compete. How do you see it changing again with the advent of human-level consciousness? What new abilities does consciousness allow for that you see contributing to next-level evolution?
There is a level of choice and creativity, a fluidity. I mean, it's a way in which there's a lot more options that can show up at each new level. I mean, when you're doing molecular stuff and then you're doing, you know, you're doing life and then you're doing social forms and then you're doing human whatever, there's more options that show up, and that is accelerating. I mean, you look at the web, you know. I mean, there's new capacities always showing up. There's new options. There's new varieties of differentness showing up. It's just the level of, like they say, the complexity is differentiation and interconnectedness, you know, interactivity combined, both really getting, you know, up to the max. And we are maximizing that, and we have more options about what we do about that. You know, we have all this diversity showing up. We have choices. We have the ability to understand deeper and deeper and broader what that diversity is all about and to use it in creative ways. So for me, it's just a vast upscaling. And we get to find out if we can do that in a way that adds up to something that's functional, or if that hyper-creativity that has happened basically allows us to create what we need to destroy ourselves. You know, so the breakthrough is going to be, you know, our survival probably to the end of the century. If we make it in basically some kind of decent form to the end of the century, we will have turned the tide. Well, it'll be evidence that we've made it. That's probably the best I can offer, the level of nuance and complexity that would be required to answer that. Observation fully is gigantic.
Well, it sounds like you and John may have a chance since you're not too far apart.
Right.
Okay. One person, Kenan Branham, this will be our last question in Houston, is asking, Tom, can you share any insight into how the web, World Wide Web system, can be mashed up with dynamic facilitation? How do we take this out of something you have to be face-to-face to do?
Hey, I can't. There's many different processes that I've thought of how they could be done on the web, and I really don't know how that can be done, how dynamic facilitation can be done on the web. I used to be very prejudiced against the web. Like the Tao of Democracy has hardly anything about the web in it, and I didn't understand very much about what was going on. I'm understanding more and more how it can be woven in, but dynamic facilitation follows the energy in a very subtle signal way, and there's lots of judgment calls, and it's an embodied practice. And it's like, how do you, like, one the most powerful part of dynamic facilitation is people feeling fully heard. How do you do that on the web? You know, because maybe if there was visuals, I haven't done enough, you know, you have a Skype conference or something, you could do dynamic facilitation maybe. I don't know.
Well, the one thing I know about that's an emerging technology, I don't know if it's in alpha stage yet, but I know it's out in beta. I think it's called TalkBox, TOKBOX. Sperry Andrews is always telling me about it because he uses it for these. He does dialogue groups that are kind of like, you know, enlightened communication or kind of, you know, spiritual dialogue, Bohmian dialogue, something like that. And it allows you to have every person's face on the same screen and face and voice, live action, video all together. It's like Hollywood Squares. I think you got about a dozen faces there talking all, and it's all live. So potentially with something like that.
Yeah, it's definitely worth an experiment, and I would encourage the caller
who obviously has a sensibility in this direction to and some kind of calling to learn dynamic facilitation and check out TalkBox and the emerging Google Wave stuff.
Right.
And I'd be really interesting if you could merge TalkBox and Google Wave and start doing experiments with it. You know, I would say it would be an unbelievable breakthrough if you managed to make it work. And I don't know how to make it work. I'm nowhere near sophisticated enough in that to do it. But, you know, get trained. Talk to Rosa.
Okay, great. Well, hey, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much, Tom. Really appreciate all of your insights and inspiration. I feel like you brought us a lot to think about and, most importantly, act on. So thanks again.
It's been a great ride.
We'll have you when you'll be joining us in a few minutes over on the Evolutionary Cafe.
Right.
You got an email by now with all the info.
Do stop by on both the cointelligence.org and the evolutionaryactivism.com websites, and you can get the whole book for free. Download it PDF if you want. If you buy it through the website, of course, I get some money for it, but I am totally delighted if you cannot do that.
Buy Tom's book.
Buy Tom's book. I'd love to talk to people who love it. Anyway.
Yeah, great. So, again, that's co-intelligence, that's co-intelligence.org for his main website, and then evolutionaryactivism.com for the new book, Reflections on Evolutionary Activism. So hope many of you connect with Tom and help him pursue and evolve this work. Okay, well, thanks again, Tom. We're going to just say a few concluding words, and I'll see you on the other side in the cafe. Just to let everybody know, we have two events scheduled next week. First, on Tuesday, I'll be speaking with integral philosopher Ken Wilber. And then on Thursday, I'll be joined by Enlightened Next editor Elizabeth DeBold. We'll be speaking about all kinds of things related to evolutionary spirituality, the integral worldview, how consciousness develops and evolves, and many other things with a couple of brilliant people. So really looking forward to both of those. And if you have any friends that you think might be interested in this series, please forward them one of our emails so they can join us. And if someone sent you this audio or you found it somewhere on the Internet and you'd like to listen into the other 18 dialogues in this series, visit evolutionaryspirituality.com. That's evolutionaryspirituality.com. If you want to learn more about my work, visit integralenlightenment.com or academyforevolutionaries.com. And I want to thank all the partners and sponsors who've made all this possible, including our event partners, Gaia Community and Enlightened Next, and all of our sponsors, The Shift Movie, Women on the Edge of Evolution, Feminine Power, The Integral Incubator, Integrative Spirituality, Next Step Integral, Global Mind Shift, Elevate Films, I Evolve, and Bay Area Integral. Okay, now we're going to shift gears and get started on our virtual Evolutionary Cafe, where you have an opportunity to come together with others who listened in and have a small group experience, engaging in conversation, much like what Tom's talking about. To participate, you need to create a personal PIN code, and you can find instructions for how to do that in the email that we sent you earlier this week. So thanks again, everybody. It's been great to have you with us. And until next time, keep evolving. We'll go ahead and unmute the lines so everybody can say goodbye. Bye. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks a lot.
Thank
bye.
You.
Awesome. Thanks.